Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. This series on what's called the documentary hypothesis has analyzed the attack on Moses as the author of Genesis and of the whole Pentateuch. We learned about our expert language and Old Testament scholar Peter Gentry in Tim Mahoney's film series, Patterns of Evidence, and he'll join us for this final episode in a few minutes. So-called higher critics claim that these Old Testament books were not written by a single author, but compiled by editors from three or four different sources. They claim they could perceive the first two sources based on which name for God appears in the text, Yahweh or Elohim. The documentary hypothesis is also called the JEDP theory, J for Yahweh, or Jehovah, as some pronounce it, and E for Elohim. The D and P for what they perceive as the last two sources, the Deuteronomist and the priestly sources. We've been discussing a small book by eminently qualified scholar Umberto Cazzuto, which presents eight lectures he delivered in 1940 during World War II at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Gentry, an accomplished academician himself, agrees with Cazzuto's showings that the use of the words Yahweh and Elohim in Genesis and throughout the Torah follows the plain and easily understood rules of literature and especially Hebrew literature in the scripture. And so if they are merely used according to basic usage, then they cannot be hidden codes pointing to mysterious original sources. Methodically, Cazzuto's lectures address the various pillars or principal claims of the documentary hypothesis. For example, that the language and style in the text revealed these mysterious sources, including, for example, whether the text said God brought the Israelites up from Egypt or brought them forth from Egypt. And we saw with Dr. Gentry's help that these most natural phrases had different meanings and the context required one or the other, so they too could not be clues to hidden sources. This pattern of evidence, if you will, against the documentary hypothesis continued with the Hebrew words used in genealogies, which have perfectly natural grammatical rules for when one or the other would be used. Then cutting a covenant versus establishing or fulfilling the covenant, and the critics say, well, look, these two come from different sources. However, they're different meanings required by the context. They view one personal pronoun as having to come from source J and another from the Elohim source and a third again from the P or priestly source. Whereas, yes, you guessed it, the normative rules of Hebrew usage explain the different pronouns used. And whether the preposition before or the adverb not yet appears in a verse will tell you they divine whether it comes from a Yahweh or an Elohim source, even though the text could be gibberish if these non-synonyms were switched, showing again that they cannot be source indicators. And we looked at the rules in Hebrew for presenting numbers, either 40 and 5 or 5 and 40 in descending or ascending order. And those critics, they think the order reveals otherwise hidden knowledge to what source was being tapped for that particular verse, when in actuality, perfectly obvious usage rules explain why different passages use descending or ascending numerical order. So as both Umberto Cazzuto and Peter Gentry explain, cutting up the text into imagined original sources actually does violence to the natural Hebrew usage, and better scholarship shows that the entire enterprise is misguided. And that brings us back to Louisville, Kentucky at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Peter Gentry, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Thank you very kindly for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Have you heard of the Hollywood website, IMDb, the International Movie Database? You've got a film credit in there, Dr. Gentry, for your appearance in Tim Mahoney's Patterns of Evidence. Congratulations for that.
Well, I'm aware of the website IMDb, but I didn't see that I had a credit there.
Yeah, you do. And your bio is in there. So that's pretty cool.
All right.
So we've arrived at Umberto Cazzuto's lecture on what he calls the third of the five pillars of the documentary hypothesis on alleged contradictions and divergent points of view in Genesis and through the Pentateuch. The first alleged divergent view that Cazzuto addresses is the claimed different views of God as the more personal God of Israel and the more distant creator and God of the nations. It seems to me that we've dealt with that in our first interview with the use of the divine names Yahweh and Elohim. Do you think we've already covered this concept, Dr.
Yes.
Gentry?
We've covered that concept. Yahweh is used when the text is dealing with the covenant and God's covenant people, and Elohim is used when it's emphasizing God as the creator and ruler of the world and of the nations.
Mm. So the very argument that these two perspectives of God are revealing two sources seems rather immature, as though the author of Genesis couldn't think of a national relationship with God and yet God's relationship to the whole cosmos. It just seems so unreasonable. And Cazzuto gives an example of the Divine Comedy, the Paradiso, Purgatorio, and Dante's Inferno, which if you apply the rule of the documentary hypothesis, you would then foolishly claim it was compiled from multiple sources because God appears different in different parts of his books.
Yes. So David J.A. Clines, he's an Old Testament scholar, he applied the principles of the documentary hypothesis to Winnie the Pooh and showed that it would have been derived from different sources.
Yeah. So obviously we could do that with any text, and therefore it seems to disqualify itself as an argument to be taken seriously. The next that Cazzuto uses, the next argument against Moses as author, is based on three different ways that God reveals himself, whether he reveals himself in a vision or dream, or by mere speech, say through a prophet, or by actually appearing to men. And they claim that these different methods prove different sources, the E, P, and J, respectively.
Yes. So they say that if God reveals himself in bodily form, the passage is from J. If he reveals himself in dreams and visions by night, it comes from the E source. And if he speaks by speech alone, it comes from the priestly source. But Cazzuto points out that prior to Moses, there are seven dreams or visions. The name Yahweh occurs in three of them, which contradicts the character of E.
It's unbelievable when like their main evidence contradicts their claim, but I'm sorry I interrupted.
That's all right. In the four which remain, Elohim is used because it suits the content of the episodes in question. So the evidence doesn't really support the claim that they're making.
Mm. And when they say, well, it can't be the J source because it's in a vision, so what they do in places, they say, okay, this verse says Yahweh, remove the name of God there, Yahweh, because we know it comes from the E source and they wouldn't use Yahweh. It's so circular, as Cazzuto points out, and much of the evidence contradicts the claim that they're trying to make. So they amend the text. That's not a word that's real familiar, I don't think, to, you know, Christians who love the Lord but haven't studied the Hebrew language. What does it mean to amend the text?
Yes, I can explain that. So there is an area of research and study that we call textual criticism. And this is based on examining how the text has been transmitted down through the centuries. We look at the witnesses that we have to the text. So, for example, for the Old Testament text, we have Hebrew manuscripts, we have the ancient Greek translation, we have the ancient Syriac translation, the ancient Targumic translations in Aramaic, we have the ancient translation in Latin, the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate made by Jerome. So we have witnesses to the text, both Hebrew manuscripts that are copies of copies of copies of copies, and we have translations that were made at a very early period. Mm. And by examining when there are difficulties or problems in the text, we can look at those witnesses and we can analyze them and decide which witnesses are attesting to the original text and which witnesses may have copyists' errors, errors made through copying the text. But when you amend the text, that is a term that is used for modern scholars correcting the text to what they think it should read without any witnesses in the entire history of the transmission of the text. So correcting the text contrary to all known witnesses.
Wow. So when they look at what they think is a verse that should be from one source, but it says Yahweh, even though all the ancient manuscripts and sources, they all say Yahweh, they'll say, no, we're going to remove that. One of the ways they treat these first seven instances of visions and dreams is when God appears to Isaac. They don't like that, so they just remove the whole verse. They say the verse doesn't belong. And when you look at Cazzuto's, it seems like to me he's demolishing their argument, because then he references his voluminous writings, far more extensive than these eight lectures. And in the eight lectures, you see how strong his rebuttal is. And you could just imagine the wealth of the treasury that he's developed against the documentary hypothesis.
Yes, the book that we're using, The Documentary Hypothesis, gives us eight lectures by Cazzuto. But it's really only a summary of his research. He wrote a book in Italian called La Questione della Genesis. I don't remember. It's like somewhere between 400 and 500 pages. Mm. So we're only just looking at the tip of the iceberg of the research that he put in.
Mm-hmm. Then Umberto Cazzuto brings up other examples of how the higher critics say they see divergences. Yes. And this gives them insight as to which source. So they look at ethics, like when Jacob deceived Isaac, and customs. And the higher critics make what seems to me to be a ludicrous assertion that in source P, the father names the child, but in source E, the mother names the baby. Now, this is hard for me to handle, Dr. Gentry, as, like I keep saying, a talk show host. When you're reading a book and you find out the father names the baby and the mother names the baby in another chapter, another baby, to say, oh, wait, there you have it. There's two different sources. It seems so absurd.
Yeah.
And then Cazzuto goes through and he looks at the actual examples and he counts them up and what they actually say.
There are 14 exceptions for this and 19 examples claim to support the rule, except that 12 of the conforming instances are for Jacob's sons, which really then could provide just one example, so that most of the actual evidence is against the documentary hypothesis.
That's just too much. So wait, let me see if I have that right. There's, let's see, 14 cases of where a mother or father names a baby, and they go against their claimed rule. 19 examples where it supports the rule, but that's pretty bad odds. If you have 33 pieces of data and you're trying to find an insight, you make a rule, and 14 of those pieces of data contradict your rule, it sounds like you've got a lousy rule, but it's even worse than that. You just said 12 of the 19 are when Jacob's sons are being named. So that could be viewed as a single example because it's one family and all their kids. So rather weak argument.
Yeah.
But Umberto, his next lecture on the fourth of the five pillars of the documentary hypothesis, he titles Duplications and Repetitions. Now, he deals primarily with the creation account. And as a creationist, we hear this from skeptics quite often, that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 provide two different creation accounts. And so the higher critics claim that Genesis 1 is from source P, and chapter 2, which speaks of the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, of course, they claim that is from source J. Dr. Gentry, what do you make of the claim that there are two contradicting creation accounts in Genesis?
Well, first of all, the scholars who proposed the documentary hypothesis were deeply influenced by the Enlightenment period, and what they were doing was imposing modern and Western ideas of literary analysis on ancient and Eastern texts. So they never asked the question, well, what were the Hebrews' own manner or rules for doing literature? How does Hebrew literature work? And if they had asked that question, they would have discovered that the ancient and Eastern approach to literature is quite different from the modern and Western approach. First of all, Hebrew literature is based on repetition. And the way it works is you begin by speaking on a topic. You begin a conversation on a topic, and then you go around that topic, and then you shut that conversation down, and then you start another conversation. And at first, it looks like you're talking about a different topic, but then the hearer realizes that you're repeating yourself. You're talking about the same topic from a different angle, a different perspective, a different point of view. And when you have those two conversations out on the table, they're like the left and right speakers of a stereo system. So when you're listening to music, do the left and right speakers have the same music or do they have different music? Well, they're both the same and they're slightly different. And that's what gives you the three-dimensional effect in your ears. And this is what the Hebrews are doing there by talking about something and then talking about it again from a slightly different angle. You get a three-dimensional idea. And so that's their way of saying, well, now I've covered the whole ball of wax. I've given you a full exposition. And most people can easily see that Genesis 1 gives you a perspective from the creation as a whole, whereas Genesis 2 is focusing more particularly on the earth and upon the creation of humans. You notice in Genesis 1:1, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Well, this pair of words, heavens and earth, occurs many, many times in the Hebrew Bible. But there's only one place in the entire Hebrew Bible where the order is changed, where instead of saying heavens and earth, it says earth and heavens. And that's in Genesis chapter 2, I think verse 4, where it's beginning the second account of creation. And that shows he's reversed the order of the two words because he's showing that the focus is now in this repetition, the focus is now on the earth in particular and on the creation of humans. So the bottom line is they never allowed the Hebrew people or the people of the ancient Near East to show them how ancient Eastern literature works, and they didn't analyze the text using those principles.
And Dr. Gentry, that was so effective thousands of years ago, the way they communicated. If you fast forward to today, certainly the greatest scripts ever written, the funniest comedians, historians, a comedian will make a joke, everybody laughs, he'll start a completely different story, different topic, but it ends up being the same joke. And people really laugh because they're proud of themselves for making the connection.
Yes.
And historians, what historian in the history of the discipline, what historian has ever started out with the details and not first given a summary and then move into the details? It seems the most normal way possible for human beings to communicate.
Yes, it is a normal way for humans to communicate. But in the Western world, our culture is based on Greece and Rome. We're deeply influenced by Aristotle, and Aristotle taught us to argue in a straight line, going from A to B by logical syllogisms. So in the Western world, we don't like repetition, and we don't understand how this kind of literature works.
Well, thank you for that insight. Certainly, when I started studying the scriptures back in the 1970s, went to Bible college, one of the first things I learned about was Hebrew parallelism, Hebrew repetition. And Dr. Gentry, that has served me well throughout my entire Christian life, because I can see it. And even although it's not as emphasized in the New Testament, these were Jews mostly writing the New Testament. You could even see it in the Greek of the New Testament.
Yes. And I think that if a Hebrew author is going to repeat himself, what you have in Hebrew poetry is you have the minimum type of repetition. So, for example, if you have two parallel lines, the first line, the A line, is the left speaker, and the second line, or the B line, is the right speaker. It's kind of a minimum version of a stereo communication, a very short stereo communication.
Right. And it becomes increasingly sophisticated if there are inversions to the parallelism, couplets, and so on.
Yes.
Cazzuto points out that if you don't recognize that the creation account, if you go from Genesis 1 to Genesis 3 with Adam and Eve in the garden and the fall, if you don't recognize that from a single source, then you have a real problem, because first, you have God as creator of a perfect world, but then second, you need an explanation for sin, disease, and death, and it's the world with the early history of Adam and Eve that is a source of moral instruction. So without it as a continuous whole, then you have a disjointed understanding, origin, foundation for God as viewed by the Hebrews.
That's exactly right. And in fact, all of your understanding is going to be lopsided. It's like listening to a stereo when only one speaker is working. For example, you would end up with a lopsided view of marriage, because in Genesis 1, the focus there on creating Adam and Eve is on reproduction, whereas in Genesis 2, you get more of the covenant relationship between the husband and wife. So you need the left and the right speaker to get a balanced three-dimensional view of what the author is communicating. If you divide them into sources, then you basically are trying to listen to music with only the left speaker working or only the right speaker working.
And the way Cazzuto sums it up is that these are unmistakable evidences of a close connection. And if you separate them, then you're only going to learn half from each source of what you need to know.
Exactly.
So when he goes on from duplications to repetitions, very similar concepts, he describes the function of repetitions, including that, as the Bible says, two or three witnesses establish a matter. And Cazzuto writes that everything done twice and thrice is confirmed and established. And I think he gives a brilliant account of the journeys of Abraham and Jacob. And now we're pretty far into his text. And then Cazzuto quotes Genesis 41, verse 32, the doubling of Pharaoh's dream. Could you talk to us about just that, the doubling of Pharaoh's dream, and then with Joseph interpreting this, could you explain In this context, the doubling of Pharaoh's dream, does it fit in with the concept of repetitions?
Yes, it does. Kasuto is appealing to that passage in the Torah where Moses says that everything will be confirmed by two or three witnesses. I don't think that's exactly what's going on. I think it's just that Hebrew literature, like ancient Near Eastern literature, is based on repetition. And it's, as I've explained, when they repeat it, it's not exactly the same. So that gives you a left speaker and a right speaker with a stereo effect, a three-dimensional idea, so to speak. So by going over the thing from a different point of view, you get a three-dimensional idea. Now, in the case of Pharaoh's dream, there's something different going on there because Joseph is interpreting the dream. And first of all, Pharaoh had two different dreams, and both dreams were communicating the same thing. And Joseph explained to Pharaoh that the fact that it had happened twice was an affirmation by God. It was a confirmation of the certainty of what would happen. So in that particular case, the repetition had to do with affirmation and confirmation and establishing it. But that doesn't mean that every repetition has to do with establishing the point.
Okay, very good point. And as we see that this is a natural and structural aspect of how the Hebrews communicated, then there is no good reason to insist that it must be a hidden clue to an alleged mysterious original source. So that brings us to the fifth of the five pillars Umberto Kasuto calls the composite sections. And it's got to be the funniest of the arguments made by the critics in their documentary Hypothesis. Of course, we avoid reading lengthy quotes on air, especially with a guest. But Dr. Gentry, I'd like to read Umberto's paragraph from page 84 of the 1961 English translation of his lectures, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay, so the audience will get a flavor for the composite sections. We find in many sections internal parallels between one verse and another. Most critics regard these parallels as superfluous duplications or as manifest contradictions, which can be explained only on the basis of the hypothesis that each of these sections was pieced together from different elements, that is to say, that it was formed by combining verses or fragments of verses culled from two or three original sections, all belonging to one theme. This is how, it is imagined, the editor set about his task. He took two narratives, one, for instance, from source J, and the other from E, both dealing with the same subject. He began to copy a few words, or a complete sentence, or several sentences from the first account. And then he proceeded to copy a few words or a complete verse or several verses from the second. Later, he left the second document and continued to copy from the first, returning subsequently to the second, and so on until all the material at his disposal was used up and both stories had been welded into a single narrative. Sometimes there were three accounts available to him, in which case he would also incorporate into his compilation here and there material from the third source. Peter, it sounds to me like that's absurd. I can't imagine an intelligent human being creating a text by doing that.
Well, I don't know how they came up with an explanation like this, except that in the 1900s, there was a lot of optimism, 18 and 1900s, there was a lot of optimism about how much better and greater we were than the ancient societies, and that's just simply not true.
Yes, we have a page on our website, rsr.org/genius, and it's a program we did, and it's quite an amazing list of examples of the genius of ancient man. It's rather egotistical to think that we're so much smarter. We have a lot more knowledge than ancient cultures did, but they were incredibly competent from all evidence, and the evidence is worldwide And it's astounding how sharp they were. So yes. Cazzuto goes on to analyze the account of Isaac's blessing of Jacob with the extraordinary deception involved. His observations to me seem brilliant and irrefragable, demonstrating how to utterly dismantle this final pillar of the documentary hypothesis so that it's all nothing but a collapsed heap of ruins, certainly not worthy to reconstruct. Do you have anything in particular, Dr. Gentry, that you'd like to highlight from Genesis chapter 27 with the blessing of Jacob?
I think that it might be useful just to read one brief paragraph here from Cazzuto.
Sure.
To show how he deals with the hypothesis. He says, and this is at the bottom of page 87, the first paragraph of the section, Genesis 27, verses 1 to 4, relates how Isaac invited Esau to bring him some of his game and to receive his benison or his blessing. The text says, when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, which still could not discern to whom the birthright belonged. Mm. He called Esau his older son and said to him, my son, and he answered, here I am. The words, and said to him, my son, and he answered, here I am, are usually deleted because the verse is attributed to J, and the use of such expressions in opening a conversation is characteristic of E.
Oh, no.
But it is difficult to agree to this. Can such simple words be regarded as peculiar to any given writer and thus excluded from use by other authors? Furthermore, although such formulae are sometimes found in conjunction with the name Elohim, which is used only by E and not by J, yet they also occur in passages that contain no divine name at all, and they are even found in association with Yahweh, which is characteristic of J. For example, in the verse, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, and he said, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, here I am, Genesis 22, verse 1. So Cazzuto literally goes word by word, verse by verse, word by word, and shows that the assumptions being made by the proponents of the documentary hypothesis are not reasonable at all.
Yeah, when you have something as iconic as the Lord in Genesis 22 calling to Abraham, 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 and he said, here I am, and this contradicts their claim in Genesis 27 about why they have to delete the opening source because it's not consistent with how they have to delete this opening passage because it's not consistent with the source that they claim it's from, it all falls apart in their own hands. Yes. All Cazzuto is doing, although it was a tremendous amount of work, is just taking them seriously and looking at the text and see if it supports their claims. And as I read this book over and over, I was cheering in my heart because their criticism is a mess. It just does not hang together. Cazzuto concludes his final eighth lecture with a brilliant observation that we've addressed briefly, Dr. Gentry, the relative chronology, that is, which writings came first and which came last of the Pentateuch and the prophets. So just asking this simple question makes the answer seem obvious, and yet it again falsifies the documentary hypothesis. So as so many higher critics assumed that the five books of the Torah were written so late that they came after the prophets wrote their books. Could we talk about that for a moment?
Yes, the assumption made by the proponents of the documentary hypothesis, and this is still assumed today, is that the Pentateuch, the first five books, what we call the Torah, weren't put into their final form until the 5th century BC.
That is so late. That's shocking to hear that said out loud, how late that is in Israel's history.
If this is true, then the Pentateuch wasn't put together until after the prophets wrote their works. And this doesn't really make any sense because the prophets are calling the people back to the covenant. God made a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai. This covenant was renewed in the book of Deuteronomy. That's called the covenant of Moab. And the prophets are like what we would call witnesses to the covenant. So, for example, when a couple gets married, there's a best man and there's a maid of honor. And the best man and the maid of honor are supposed to be the witnesses to the wedding. They're the witnesses to the covenant that's being made. And in many places, they sign their names as witnesses to the document that is the legal document in the eyes of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prophets are like, they're the witnesses to the covenant. So if a marriage falters and there's a division between the husband and wife, what the best man and the maid of honor are supposed to do is they're supposed to say, "We witnessed the covenant that you made before God, and we're appealing to you to come back to the terms of the covenant." Well, that's what the prophets are. They're the witnesses to the covenant, and they're calling Israel to come back to the covenant that was made in the time of Moses. Well, it's sort of ridiculous if the covenant comes after the people who are calling them back to the covenant.
Right, right. Yeah, what a great point. In his penultimate paragraph, Cazzuto wrote, quote, "Even the oldest of the literary prophets, Amos and Hosea, at no time proclaim new ideals or concepts or beliefs, and this is just as true of those who came after them. The prophets speak of their ideals and concepts and beliefs as of principles with which their listeners are already quite familiar. They never claim to have created new doctrines or laws. It is manifest that no such thought occurred to them."
Yes. So another example of this is there was a scholar by the name of Klaus Westermann. And he wrote a book showing that everything in the prophets comes from the Torah.
Wow.
And even their expressions and their sentences, their very sentences. An example would be Jeremiah loves this phrase, the stubbornness of their evil heart. Well, that phrase occurs 14 times in the Bible, once in the book of Deuteronomy, and the other 13 times are in Jeremiah. Mm-hmm. So he got the phrase out of the book of Deuteronomy, mm-hmm. and he loved it, and he put it into his preaching.
And that, I think, is a pattern, as you just referenced this scholar. It's a pattern, as a Bible teacher at Denver Bible Church, we've taught through most of the books of the Bible now, verse by verse, and over and over and over, we recognize that if you're not familiar, especially with Genesis and Exodus, but indeed the first five books of the Bible as a unit, you're not going to understand the prophets. Over and over, right now, we're in the middle of Jeremiah, and what a phenomenally great book that the Holy Spirit has inspired for our benefit. So thanks for that example. It's just great, Dr. Gentry.
You're welcome.
Now we have completed our summary of Cazzuto's work. So back to your observation, you noted briefly that the higher critics apply the rules of the documentary hypothesis to shred the Bible, but not to the other ancient literature of the time. How about the Babylonian Enuma Elish, or the Epic of Gilgamesh, or the Ippur Papyrus, the Code of Hammurabi? Do these scholars, do they try to disassemble those texts?
Well, some of these texts have long histories. So, for example, the Epic of Gilgamesh. We have many copies of this from the ancient Near East, and some of them date to the early Sumerian period. Some of them date to the middle Babylonian period. Some of them date to the late Babylonian period. And you can actually use these different documents that are dated. We can actually date them to different times. We can show how the story was actually changed over the centuries. That's a case where they can actually show we actually have the early sources. and we can show how those sources were used by later authors.
And but, a story often is aggrandized over time and embellished.
Yes.
And over centuries, that is not surprising. But to claim that the original source is actually from multiple sources, yes, and there was no original author, I think that's claim.
Well, to apply an approach like the documentary hypothesis, you have to have the earlier sources. You actually have to have the sources, and you have to be able to date them to an early period. And then you have to show that at a later time, people modified those. So, for example, we could do that with the Arthurian legends, the legends about King Arthur, because we have the earlier sources, we have later sources, and we can show how the story developed and grew over the centuries and was altered by different authors. For example, National Geographic puts out these courses called the Great Courses. And there's a course on the Arthurian legends, and the professor was excellent. And she showed how we have the earlier sources. She showed how those grew by accretion and modification and so on down through the centuries. But in the case of the documentary hypothesis, they haven't been able to identify the sources. So that's the problem.
Mm. And in, for example, say the creation epic Enuma Elish, where we have multiple copies of that, which is astounding to me, and the city god where a copy might be found might be Marduk or Tiamat, or these ancient Babylonian gods, and we could see where they would take the Enuma Elish and they'd insert the name of their own deity, their own city's god, into the story.
Yes.
But all that is different, again, from saying, okay, the earliest version we have, we're identifying these multiple sources.
The methodology in the documentary hypothesis is not used by modern scholars to deal with other ancient Near Eastern texts.
Okay. And to me, that's the bottom line that shows a bias that was designed, like you talked about the Enlightenment, and to undermine the authority of the scriptures. And other texts, obviously, they recognize have no authority over them as individuals, these higher critics, whereas the Bible claims to have authority over us. So that's the text that got their wrath, I think. Now, today, in the year 2020, the Hebrew University, do you think that they would welcome a defense of the integrity of the Torah's authorship like they did in the summer of 1940?
I don't know for sure. I know some of the scholars at the Hebrew University. I think some of them actually accept theories like the documentary hypothesis. So I don't know that they would be keen on the lectures by Casuto or not.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, for example, there's another university in Israel is the Bar-Ilan University, University of Bar-Ilan. They have 18 professors of Bible, but I don't know what their opinions are on these things.
Okay. If I could remind the audience of the historical context when Casuto gave his lectures, there was this atrocious anti-Semitism growing in Germany and elsewhere. And unrelated to that, Britain and France declared war on Germany in September 1939 in support of their ally 2 days after the Nazis invaded Poland. So there were incredible tensions building. And just a couple months before Casuto's lectures, Germany occupied Denmark and invaded Norway, and then they blitzkrieged through the Netherlands and Belgium, and that's when they crossed over into France and attacked there. And tragically, as history records, the slaughter of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children, and of course many others. Thankfully, Zionism gained strength and would birth the modern nation of Israel just 3 years after the war. So today, the modern state of Israel, it has significant political and military strength. And so to me, Dr. Gentry, it seems to me that one of the reasons that Casuto was welcomed to present this is because people were looking back desperately to their roots.
Yes.
And so he was welcomed. And today, sadly, many do not support the integrity of the Torah's authorship, even in many of our Protestant seminaries.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's an easy way, Dr. Gentry, for me to encourage folks to see your appearance in the Patterns of Evidence Moses controversy film. And that's if they purchase that movie from us at our Real Science Radio store at our website. But could you list some of your other works so that we could link to them in our show summary?
Yes. Well, I've written two types of works. One type is scholarly and technical. The other type is more popular to help the average person. So along that line, there is a book called Kingdom Through Covenant, authored by myself and Stephen J. Wellum. That's 900 pages. There's a 275-page abridgment called God's Kingdom Through God's Covenants. I've written a little book called How to Read and Understand the Biblical Prophets that explains in simple terms how Hebrew literature works and how to understand what they're communicating. And then at Southern Seminary, they have a program called Honest Answers, where people can write in and ask questions, and then they record or video a professor answering those questions. And so I've recorded four videos on YouTube under the Honest Answers program.
Well, that's very helpful, and we will link to those sources. I'd like to thank both of you, actually, posthumously, Umberto Cazzuto, and you, Dr. Peter Gentry, for the hard work of true scholarship and the wonderful insights that arise from that work. We are in your debt.
Well, thank you very kindly.
Well, you're very welcome, and may God bless you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And to the audience, guys, going into the future through 2020 and beyond, when Christians are challenged by atheists, other skeptics, with the documentary hypothesis, we're hoping to make this series and Cazzuto's book easily discoverable. So you can help us do that by linking to this series. If ever you see someone mention the documentary hypothesis, if you're inclined to post the link to this series on social media, it's so easy, rsr.org/documentary hypothesis or rsr.org/gentry. Both will get people there. And then another way to help is to look at our store online, rsr.org. Click on the store. We have a whole section under Real Science Radio for apologetics and the defense of the faith. So thank you for tuning in. For Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Benyart. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away.